Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. And we're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to welcome Matt Bambara. He is an Iraq veteran, and Daniel Craig, who is a Gulf War veteran and member of Veterans for Peace. Winter Soldier, the 1971 documentary, is being shown tonight at the Santa Fe Film Center at 7 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good morning.
Morning.
So, Winter Soldier, what was that original investigation and film all about, Daniel?
It was the investment of a bunch of Vietnam veterans into why they were sent to Southeast Asia. And I think, to me, after watching the film before, it was a big part of their own healing process, coming to terms with being sent for a specific reason, being told a story about Vietnam and why we were there, and coming to learn the truth of their tour of duty, or tours of duties for those who were multiple tour people, that what they were told and what they experienced were two different things. And I think a big part of it, without great detail, was a very deep wound to their psyche and to their bodies and their spirits.
The film screened in Santa Fe a few years ago, and we had on this program Scott Camille, who was one of the original people, who mm-hmm. spoke very eloquently and at quite some length in the original Winter Soldier film. And he spoke about the atrocities he'd committed. And what was really striking about it was that he didn't really deeply know that what he was doing was wrong until he had actually talked about it and gone through that whole process of the Winter Soldier investigation and said it out loud.
Mm-hmm.
How does that compare to your experience and your perception of soldiers' experience now?
Well, my experience was going through basic training. And it goes back further than basic training, I think, for us as human beings. Is our learning process is a process of conditioning to such a great degree. And I think by the time a male U.S. citizen is 17, 18 years old, you've been experiencing certain conditioning processes from childhood, you know, play soldier, play army, play war. And so it's not that much of a stretch necessarily to go into the military and have that concept and those ideas reinforced. What you pick up is different behaviors. You pick up new behaviors. Whereas before, you know, when I was a kid, we'd play with sticks and that was our weapon. And then you got an M16 in your hand. Or from my experience, my case, I was in field artillery. So you have a 155mm howitzer in your hand. and you're conditioned that this is how you do it. This is what you do. And you don't vary from that theme very much in the course of training. The training is all conditioning, you know. So you're taught to think independently in certain ways because you need to be able to do that and think on your feet and adapt to situations. But you're also conditioned to do certain behaviors in certain situations without thinking. It becomes just second nature.
And so there's a real disconnect from one's empathy. In other words, you have to kill somebody without feeling it, if that's what you are put in the position of doing. And I think the thing that's so striking about the Winter Soldier film that's screening tonight is that people, when they reflect on it, have an incredibly intense experience, as does the audience watching.
Mm-hmm. It's true. You know, I keep having to remember that when Winter Soldiers was done in 71, winter 71, you look back at Vietnam and our involvement as early as the 40s, late 40s, into the 50s, into actual combat troops in 65, there was no internet. Our information that we gathered about other parts of the world was if you were fortunate enough to be in a town or a city that had a library and you actually went in there, you had an encyclopedia. And so our knowledge was limited. And I think in part the government and the military really play on the ignorance of people. So that way it makes that conditioning process much easier. It's like if you call them subhuman, if you call them less than, and then you do the training that you do in the military, it's not that hard to look at them as less than human, whoever the enemy is, wherever they may be.
So you went through a process after the Gulf War was over in which you started to question.
Not right away. I was in the military about another year and a half after the Gulf War. And so I was still in that insulated society of the military. I was active duty, so I didn't come back to New Mexico, for instance, and go back to a civilian job. I went back to Germany with the people I was in the Gulf with during that time frame. And it was after I got out of the military and a few years later, actually, that I started to question why I had done it, what I had done, my involvement in it. And then the bigger picture of me as a citizen working for the government, basically.
I'd just like to add that despite all the mayhem and chaos that you experienced during war, it all seemed relatively normal at the time because you're experiencing there with other people that are of the same mind frame and you're sort of on the same side, so to speak. And so despite the fact that bombs are exploding all around you, it just seems like another day.
That's the job site.
Matt, how did you decide to enlist? When did you do it and why?
I enlisted in the military approximately 1 month before 9/11, and I grew up in a suburb of New York City. So I can't say that I enlisted necessarily for patriotic reasons or because of family ties to the military, but certainly after 9/11 happened in my community, it seemed to have a direct effect on my home community and firefighters and police officers that perished in on that day. And so I left for boot camp a month later, and there was a sense of patriotism at that point. You know, I did feel like I was doing something noble and something patriotic.
And so you went into the Navy?
That's correct.
And what did you do then?
Oh, I served for 3 years on active duty. I wasn't in the Navy in the traditional sense. I was never on a ship. I was part of a construction unit called the Seabees, and we flew everywhere we went. And in 3 years active duty, I was in Japan, Italy, Spain, Kuwait, and Iraq.
And so how did you feel when you found out you were going to be deployed to Iraq?
I didn't know that I was being deployed to Iraq because I was 5.5 months in on a 6-month deployment in Italy when they asked if we would be part of this one mission. And we got caught up in Spain for several weeks before that. And it was never clear that we were actually going there until like the day before we went into country. Like, it was all speculation.
And what was your particular mission in Iraq?
Building prisons.
So you were building prisons in which Iraqis would be kept?
It wasn't none of the details were really explained to us. And even though that's what we were initially sent there for, it was total chaos. Nothing was ready for us. There was no 2x4s or nothing to work with. There was no tools. Like, most of the time we spent there was just wasted.
So what was it like? I mean, what was your experience like each day?
In the 4 weeks that I was there, I was on 4 different projects. At one point I was setting up perimeter fences. At other times, I was just cleaning up after the Army had initially come in and taken over this. We were stationed on a former Iraqi base. And so when the Army initially came in, they left a huge, huge mess of all their equipment behind that we were responsible for just cleaning up.
And so when you a moment ago talked about the bombs dropping around you, did you have that experience?
Yes. Every day. And the last week I was there marked the 1-year anniversary of the fall of Baghdad, and we got bombed three to four times a day. We had mortars in camp and had to wear full battle rattle at all times.
Did you ever think this is going to be my last day on Earth?
No, not really. I mean, it all seemed normal and at the time. You know, you don't really question I don't think that you can go there in your mind just because it's not a healthy way to live under that amount of stress, you know.
How did you and the other soldiers, your colleagues, make sense of what you were doing there? Did you talk about it? I mean, there's so much dissent at this point, and some of it is from soldiers and some of it is from the general public. But what was the atmosphere like among you and the other soldiers?
At the time, I'd say that the majority of the people that I was there with were pro-war and pretty okay with being over there at the time. But there was a lot that hadn't really been revealed at that point in terms of, you know, the weapons of mass destruction that never existed and various other lies that we were told to go over there. But the biggest incentive I found for people that were willingly participating in this was just the money, you know. The per diem for being in Iraq is pretty substantial in comparison to other places.
Even for regular soldiers, not just private contractors.
That's correct.
How did you understand the rationale for the military operation there then, and how do you understand it now in comparison all these several years later?
I mean, in my opinion, it's just about oil, you know, and securing our interests.
And that's accurate. We, in addition to the oil, too, though, we need a presence in Southwest Asia. You've got China, India, and now Russia vying for global power in a way that we were fighting with the Russians or the Soviets at the time over to such a great degree during the Cold War. Putin just is stepping down, but he's not stepping down. He's stepping sideways. He'll become the next prime minister. Medvedev becomes the new president, but Russia's ascending again. And you've got China, India, and the United States all looking for energy resources. And so it's Iraq, but it's also the stans, you know, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, natural gas, all these different places with natural resources that everybody wants and needs. And so we have our foot in the door, so to speak, and it's all about that. Democracy is with a little d. There's no capital on that one. In fact, it's sort of an aside in this entire picture.
Matt, how come you are going to the Winter Soldier investigation, the new one that's happening in Washington, D.C., the 13th through 16th of March? What made you want to go there and do it?
I just feel like it's a really important time for the peace community to have its voice heard. With two of the three possible presidential candidates only pretending that they're going to end the war over there, I feel like it's not a coincidence that all of a sudden the economy has become the major issue in the presidential debate.
For you as a member of the peace community, I mean, I would think that part of the deal would be, you know, as a veteran and as part of the peace community, as you call yourself, going to talk to other soldiers of like mind.
Certainly. I mean, I want to encourage anyone that, you know, is also against this war that it's okay to refuse deployment, as I did the second time that they asked me to deploy to Iraq. I refused to go, and that was a really difficult decision, and there's not a whole lot of information out there as to what your rights are and how to maneuver yourself once you come to that conclusion that you don't want to be a part of this, you know.
So what actually happened? That you got a letter saying you were going and you just said no? Or how did it go?
I had checked into my reserve unit and I was obligated to 3 more years of active reserve time. And the week that I checked in was the week that they found out that they were going to make a deployment. And it took about an entire year for it to fully come together. But I was initially right off the bat pretty much refusing to go. And essentially I was taken out to lunch by my commanding officer and asked to explain why I felt the way I did, and I articulated my argument in a way that persuaded him to think that I didn't need to go back a second time. And
what did you say?
Just basically that I had felt like I had been tricked, you know, into participating in this war, and that I simply wasn't willing to, you know, put my life on the line to defending America's oil interests.
And that was enough for him to say, okay, Matt, guess you're right. You don't have to go to Iraq.
No. I mean, I spoke of specifics, you know, things like, you know, that they ran out of vaccination shots prior to sending us into country. And half of us got vaccinations that included anthrax and all sorts of other horrible things that, you know, half of us got and half of us didn't get. And that was okay with them. They sent us into country anyways. And same thing with our M16s. You know, half of us, we all got issued M16s, but only half of us got an opportunity to sight our guns in the desert, and then half of us didn't, and they didn't care. They just sent us into country with guns that couldn't shoot straight and without, you know, anthrax. And all the warfare preparation that I did prior to going to Iraq consisted of chemical warfare and wearing gas masks and full chemical, you know, suits in really hot weather And as when it came time to go into country, they didn't have any of that equipment. And that was supposedly one of the biggest reasons why we were going there in the first place, was because they had weapons of mass destruction and chemical warfare that they were going to use against us, which clearly they weren't concerned about, because I never got a gas mask.
Did you in any way influence your other co-reservists? I mean, were you talking to them as well?
Yeah, I think that was one of their reasons for helping me get out in a peaceful manner, because I was willing to take it to any extreme necessary. And I was kind of – I was only one of two other people in my reserve unit who had ever been into Iraq. And so people would come to me and ask for, you know, what it was going to be like. And I would tell them bluntly and honestly. And I think it kind of scared some people.
Meaning your superiors, quote unquote.
Yeah.
How do you find people have related to you since you've come home, knowing that you were in Iraq?
Sometimes I just don't necessarily relate to or understand the notion for people to thank veterans. You know, I never considered what I did to be anything that heroic or something that I was proud of necessarily. You know, to be quite honest with you, it's the opposite. The thing that I'm most proud of in my life is refusing my second deployment to Iraq. So,
and so, where does that put you now? I mean, are you on some list? Are you honorably discharged? Are you still a member of active military or of the reserve?
I'm still a part of the inactive reserves.
The inactive reserve, the thing in that is you did an 8-year enlistment, didn't you? So you sign up to be on active duty for 3 years. What you're not really clearly and specifically told is that you have signed up for an 8-year commitment. 3 years active duty, 5 years in the National Guard, the Army Reserve, or the inactive reserve. So for that 8-year period, you're still subject to being recalled for military service. Lots of cases, you don't find that out till after you've enlisted and discovered, I didn't sign up for 3 years, I signed up for 8.
Matt, when you were a soldier on active duty, what was your relationship like with the other soldiers who you worked with?
I can't say that I was necessarily of a similar mindset as a lot of the people I was around, and I think that was most clear when I was sent to Spain, and I was kind of in limbo waiting to find out if we were going to Iraq, if we were going to Afghanistan, if we were just going to go home at that point. And we were sitting around watching the news every day, and gay rights was a big issue in the news at that point. And I was sitting around a lot of folks that were essentially gay bashing all day and all night about, you know, gay rights. And it got to a point where I eventually spoke out and pretty quietly to myself, more or less, but was labeled, you know, a hippie and not to be one of them, and kind of forcefully made to keep my opinion to myself.
Meaning what? They beat you up?
Not necessarily beat me up and punch me in the face, but physically put me in a position where I wasn't speaking my mind anymore.
Did you have a similar experience in any way, Daniel, when you were in the Gulf War?
This wasn't something that was really talked about or addressed in any way. Not specifically during the course of the Gulf War, but during the course of my service, you know, homophobia was just rampant. One of the tools that's used is in the conditioning process is to belittle people, and if you can get at someone by talking about how they're less than a man, that becomes impetus and incentive for them to become a man and do what men do. That's the approach. So, you know, like cadence, a lot of it is demeaning and belittling to women. A lot of times there's this covert and overt homophobia in the daily routine. You know, it's to a great degree reflective of general society. But I think it's even more ramped up in the military because this is about masculinity. This is about, you know, combat. This is about training people to function in that environment. And you use the tools available to get people to it's coercion in lots of cases, you know. When the training and the conditioning don't work, then you use coercion and you use threats of violence used, you know, overtly and covertly again. It's very much emphasized what's okay and what is not. That is one of the things in the military that was not okay. And I'm presuming today it's still not okay. You know, the don't ask, don't tell stuff that we went through as a country and a military with Clinton. It's a very clouded issue in society in general. And in the military, it's clouded in one way, but in another way, it's very distinct, black and white. You know, homophobia is just rampant.
Matt, a lot of people, when they come back from war, have post-traumatic stress syndrome to a greater or lesser degree. What is your own experience of that?
It's a question that I've gone back and forth on a lot, you know, since coming back from Iraq. And my impression is that it's really a matter of what you make of it. You know, I think that the way that I feel towards our government and towards society at large, you know, in a lot of ways is an organic response to what I experienced, you know, and I don't think there's anything unnatural about it, but it's really what you make of it to a large degree. You know, if you allow this experience to, if you dwell on it and allow it to affect you in a negative way, then I suppose the government deems you as, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder. And if you allow this experience to influence you in a positive way, then I suppose the government says you do not have post-traumatic stress disorder. So as of right now, I have gone through one cycle of testing through the VA, in which they declined my post-traumatic stress disorder.
So you're okay,
according to the government.
What about you, Daniel? Have you yourself gone through that, or worked with other veterans who are in that position?
I've worked with a lot, not a lot. I've worked with a few veterans who are in that position, and my own experience was, I think part of what helped me deal with the fact that I was in combat in Iraq was that when I left Iraq, I went back to Germany with the unit I had been in for the previous 2.5 years. So there it is again, back to that insulated community of like-minded people. We're all soldiers. We'd been together for X amount of time prior to our deployment. Came back to a small concern in Germany, and so we were very, very insulated. There wasn't a lot of moving out of that, didn't move into a non-supportive environment. You know, people coming back from Vietnam, for instance, wearing their fatigues, got on an airplane in Da Nang. X amount of hours later, they're in the San Francisco airport, still in fatigues, no debriefing, nothing except the duffel bag and the clothing on their back. And then they're thrown into civilian society, especially the draftees. You know, there they come from combat to, you know, 36 hours later, the United States, supposedly, you know, the peacetime environment, with all of those experiences behind them, with all of their own trauma, nothing to help transition. For those of us on active duty, I really think after any conflict like that, being in an insulated unit, you know, that's the word. The key word is unit. You're around the people you were with during the combat, during the conflict. And for me, it was just, you know, I think you talked about it a while. It was just business as usual. You know, we went back to Germany. We didn't have vehicles for a while because they came back to Europe by ship. But, you know, M16 training, first aid training, nuclear, biological, chemical training, just all those things that we were able to do without our vehicles, we did. So there was a smooth transition from there back to home base. It wasn't until I'd been out of the military a few years that all this stuff started hitting me. Everything I had done and been through, I started questioning to a deeper level about why was what I did okay, when for me, it turns out it really wasn't.
And I agree. Most of the veterans friends that I have that I went to Iraq with didn't really start questioning what they were a part of and what they were doing over there until they had an opportunity to get out of that, you know, the unit or that sheltered mindset. You know, I could tell you that the VA healthcare systems are not adequately facilitated with psychiatrists to help all the people out there that do have questions and are struggling with mm-hmm. you know, what they did.
You know people in that position besides yourself.
Yes, myself included.
Yeah.
There's a great book It's a short story by Tom Wolfe, and I believe the title is called Ambush at Fort Bragg. And the dialogue between the characters in the book is just incredible, and it talks about the word unit and what that means and loyalty to the unit down at the, you know, squad level, up to platoon, up to as a military in you know, national level country. But this guy is just talking about this is what it means to be part of a unit. And so you conform to the parameters, you conform to the mentality. So there's all those things we talked about earlier, the homophobia, the sexism, the nationalism. You conform to the needs of the unit. Your whole life revolves around that organization.
And I would think that at the time there's some real security in that as well.
Your life depends on it, and the life of your partners depends on working as a team. You know, there's that. That's why you conform, because it's a matter of life and death for so many people, whatever size the unit is. You know, you're only as strong as the weakest link in the chain.
Do you have lasting friendships from your military service, Daniel?
No.
What about you, Matt?
I've managed to keep in touch with probably two or three of the people that I encountered, that I met through the service. And I actually just received a phone call from a really dear friend of mine just last week, and he's stationed in Afghanistan right now. And I was telling him about the Winter Soldier investigation and how it was the fact that he's there right now that's a tremendous part of why I want to participate in this event. And he sounded really supportive and understanding of it up until the point where I mentioned the war, you know, the war crimes. And it only started to shed light on the fact that, like, I think that some of the soldiers are concerned that they don't feel personally responsible for what they participated in, you know, to some degree, because that was the standard, that was the norm, and they were just following orders in a lot of cases. And so I think that they feel guilty. And when I mentioned that aspect of the protest, it became really defensive and started telling me, well, you know, you weren't there. You didn't guard these prisons. You don't know what these people were like, and you don't know what I had to put up with. And I'm like, Dave, you know, I'm on your side, man. Like, I hear you, but like, people need to know what's going on over there and what our country is asking of these soldiers to participate. You know, I think a lot of Americans are just somewhat unaware of the realities of war and what it really means to be involved in a war.
Mm-hmm. You're following orders. And I read a quote by Dave Klein. I was telling you about it earlier. Basically, a lot of us came to the point where it's like we looked at what we did, and it was not okay. In spite of being told, if you shoot that person, you're justified shooting that person. You are justified in whatever that behavior is, because at the moment, it was appropriate, for lack of a better word. And then you come to find out that I'll speak for myself. I went to war based on a series of lies, mistruths, and misinformation. And, you know, it took me going through what I went through personally, because it was in my face. There was no getting around this. After I lost my son, years later, I was faced with taking a look at why everything went down the way it did and the choices I made, and I found it was not okay. I still have to take responsibility for my actions, which part of my being in Veterans for Peace is.
What actions are you talking about?
Going to Iraq in 1991, knowing that it was a lie. Kuwait was not a democracy. They kept using the D word.
But, I mean, did you do things specifically that if you could do it again, you wouldn't do?
Kill people. I mean, I went to Iraq and killed people based on the misinformation and the lies that this is about democracy. This is about this poor little defenseless country being overcome. Iraq, Kuwait, that whole area has a long, long history. It makes the United States look like a toddler in terms of chronological history. And I knew it was a lie, and I went anyway. One of my dilemmas had been, had I had the intestinal fortitude and the morals and scruples and all that, I would have said, no, I will not go do this. Is it justified for militaries to exist and fight wars? Yeah. But based on what I know today and what I knew in part back then, I was going to go kill people based on lies, and I did it anyway. And part of my thing has been, how do I make amends, basically, to myself and to those that are no longer here?
I went to the Iraq Veterans Against War website, IVAW.org, and there is a preview of the Winter Soldier investigation where they have interviewed soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan. And one of the things that I'm really struck by is the understanding that these soldiers have of when one person, you know, Iraqi or whoever, loses a child, it sets off a whole chain of anger, grief, and real enmity mm-hmm. against us.
Well, the culture is that you take revenge when you've been wronged, and it goes, I mean, it transcends a generation. This is generational stuff. So the damage we've done on the ground in Southwest Asia, it's not going to be like Vietnam, I don't believe. You go to Vietnam now, which I personally haven't done, but I have a number of Vietnam veteran friends who've been back there over the years. It's behind them. Vietnam, I forgot the ratio, but a bulk of the population of Vietnam was not even alive during the Vietnam. Well, they call it the American War. They were not born yet. So for them, they've put it behind them. They've been fighting for 1,000+ years because they keep getting invaded. But in Iraq, it's a totally different culture, totally different mindset. When you have been wronged, you exact revenge, and this is generational. So
even if it's the children's children, they're still exacting revenge.
It will be in mind, if nothing else. If they can't act on it, it will always be a thought to be acted upon 10, 15 years from now, potentially. That's a cultural issue. If we stopped everything right now and could blink everyone out of that country, there's going to be fallout for the next many, many years.
What is Veterans for Peace up to these days in Santa Fe and on a national level?
Well, on a national level right now, what's in front of us is our supporting the IVAW Winter Soldiers hearings. And, you know, financially as well as in other ways, just trying to get the word out there to people, trying to get people come into the hearings. Locally, one of the things we're doing is having this fundraiser tonight to help support the whole hearing process. And also, Matt's going to be going from here, so part of it is support of him specifically. And still the process of educating the general public about war and peace.
If people want to get involved with Veterans for Peace, first of all, do they have to be a veteran to join the group?
No. Veterans for Peace consists of veterans and non-veterans. Non-veterans are referred to as associate members rather than non-veterans. And locally, our website is www.vfp-santafe.org. You can get on the web to look at that. For people who don't have web access, my mobile number is 505-660-6848. We don't have an office per se, so we don't have a line that people can call into for information. But if you want any information locally, feel free to call me at that mobile number, and I will do my best to get you the information you need. Nationally, it's www.veteransforpeace.org to find out what's going on nationwide. Internationally, too, a lot of our projects are not just limited to the continental United States.
What else are they doing?
Well, up until the invasion in 2003, there was the Iraq Water Project, which was helping local communities in Iraq develop infrastructure for water because...
And now Halliburton's taken over that?
And they're doing a bang-up job. As far as I know, yeah, Halliburton's KBR have taken over that type of stuff. I think there's still some people on the ground in Iraq, but it's very limited because it's such a dangerous situation. In Vietnam and in Laos, there's Veterans for Peace members who are there on the ground working with different projects. I'm not really familiar with them anymore. It's been a long time since I'd really thought about them. But Vieques, you know, in Puerto Rico, a lot of work with Veterans for Peace, trying to get them to close down those proving grounds or, you know, testing grounds with the depleted uranium issue. Nationally, you know, the Hurricane Katrina relief operation, Veterans for Peace was very prominent in assisting down in the New Orleans area, getting people fed, getting people clothed, getting people sheltered.
anything else that you want to talk about?
One thing I would like to put out there for people who are having a change of mind and heart, who may be thinking about the military, or who may actually have enlisted already, or are on active duty or reserve, is putting out the phone number for the GI Rights Hotline. They're very involved. In fact, their goal is to help people when they're contemplating conscientious objector status. Their number is 877-447-4487. And if there's any individuals out there who are having questions about their military service, or contemplating how do I get out of my contract, the GI Rights Hotline is an incredible group of people helping answer those questions. The other place in town that's available that maybe not lots of people know about is the Vet Center over on Brothers Road off of St. Michael's, off of Siringo near St. Michael's High School. They are an asset in this community for people coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq and World War II and Vietnam and the Gulf War for counseling services, group and individual counseling services. And they're very valuable in our community.
Anything you want to add?
Nope, I'm just hoping that we will get a number of people out tonight to watch this film of the original Winter Soldiers and take a look at their role as citizens in this country, because we've produced a new generation of veterans who come closest to the Vietnam veterans, in my lifetime anyway. And I think it's important that people support the healing that is, I think, a big part of this process.
Winter Soldier, the original documentary from 1971, is being shown tonight at the Santa Fe Film Center on St. Michael's Drive at 7 o'clock in the evening. And you can go to santafefilmfestival.com. Matt Bambara is an Iraq veteran, and Daniel Craig is a Gulf War veteran and a member of Veterans for Peace. Thank you so much for being here with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to welcome Reese Peterson. She is the Executive Director of the Santa Fe Conservation Trust. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. I'm happy to be here today.
Tomorrow is Election Day.
Yes.
And what does that mean for you?
Well, the Santa Fe Conservation Trust is the open space and trails nonprofit here in Santa Fe, and our mission is to help preserve a network of protected open natural lands for wildlife habitat and for human enjoyment in and around our county, so that there will always be healthy places for people to play and for wildlife to function. And that's one of the reasons I'm so personally excited about this election tomorrow on March 4th, is the general obligation bond for recreation. It goes for parks and trails, and we've been hearing a lot about it. There was a lot in yesterday's newspaper about it. But we're particularly excited about it at the Santa Fe Conservation Trust because there are 5 trail systems in the city that are targeted for improvement or expansion with these funds.
And Which trail systems are those?
Well, we'll start with one that everybody knows, the Santa Fe Rail Trail. That's the one that starts down at the rail yard and goes all the way out to Lamy.
Now, does this mean that you're walking across St. Francis?
Well, for the time being, yes, that part of the trail system is not installed yet. But the long-term plans are to have a pedestrian crosswalk there in some way so that it will be safe to cross. But in the meantime, there are miles and miles of the trail that the alignment's there, but the improvements are not. Some parts of that trail through the city are still unimproved dirt with litter and that sort of thing. And so these trail bonds will be used to start to pave parts of that through the city so that you'll actually be able to get from, say, down by Rodeo Road, you can get on the rail trail and ride your bicycle all the way to downtown safely.
Now, these trails, are they about paved roads, paved trails for bicycles primarily, or is it also hiking with your dog in the wilderness kind of thing?
Well, there are both. The what they call urban trails are the ones that are paved through the city, and major urban trails that we know about in the city might be familiar to people are Arroyo de los Chamisos Trail, which runs east and west from about, currently it picks up at Zia and St. Francis and runs west out toward Sam's Club. They're planning on using bond funds from tomorrow's election, if it passes, to extend that trail both to the east and the west. That's currently a paved trail. But also, as you know, there are some unpaved trails that belong to the city and or the county, including the Dale Ball Trail system, La Tierra trails, which are up in the northwest quadrant of the city, are great for hiking, biking, and even for equestrian use. So the rail trail is slated for improvement with the general obligation bonds that we're going to be voting for tomorrow. The river trail. Have you heard about that?
No.
As you know, the Santa Fe River.
What river?
The Santa Fe River. Everybody's heard of the mythical Santa Fe River.
Yeah, that dry thing with rocks in it that when it rains really hard has a trickle.
Yeah, exactly. As you know, the city is working on acquiring water rights to permanently make that river wet all the time. And we as citizens are able to contribute toward that fund through our water bills. But in addition, tomorrow's vote on the bond measure will bring in a great deal of money to start to develop the river trail and to actually improve the erosion that's along the Santa Fe River. Do you know when you drive around certain parts of town, you can see the dry bed of the Santa Fe River, and there's litter down there, and there's, you know, all sorts of accumulated sediment from erosion. A lot of that's going to be cleaned up, planted with native plants, running, biking, hiking trails put in. Benches. It's going to be absolutely gorgeous, and the money from it will come from tomorrow's election. So we really, at the Santa Fe Conservation Trust, are very excited about tomorrow's vote and hope that everyone can get out and vote for the Parks and Trails bond issue.
Where does the money actually come from?
The money will come from property taxes. You may not know, that Santa Fe in New Mexico has some of the lowest property tax rates in the United States. We're very fortunate. And if this bond passes, it will raise our taxes very slightly. Basically, for the average, about $2 a month for every home, every $100,000 of home value in the city. So that's not a lot of money to pay for enormous amount of benefit that we're getting from these parks and bonds monies. The Arroyo de los Chamisos Trail will benefit the Santa Fe River Trail, the rail trail, as we had mentioned, Tierra Contenta trails. Those are the trails in the newer southwest quadrant of the city. So many people live there, and they've got a nice beginning of a trail system, but again, that will get expanded and improved with these monies, as will the Acequia Trail, or the Acequia Madre Trail, which runs sort of parallel to Cerrillos Road and through neighborhoods and along the old Acequia Madre. That'll be great.
So this is, by and large, really kind of an urban trail system, I mean, with some exceptions, but it's really about providing places for people to move around on foot or on bicycle in the city of Santa Fe.
Yes, exactly. To get from one part of the city to the other in a recreational way, or if you're like me and enjoy riding your bike around town to get to work but don't like riding on the streets, these trails will provide a really nice way of getting from one place to another while enjoying some nature and seeing some birds and meeting your neighbors.
So the place where the trails is there actually going to be more planting of trees and things like that?
Well, I'm really glad that you asked that, because as you know, in the last few years during the drought, we have watched a lot of the vegetation in our parks die. And largely that's because some of our irrigation systems are pretty antiquated in our city. The money for tomorrow's bond election will also go toward upgrading antiquated irrigation systems and replanting trees and vegetation. So not only will we be able to replace lost vegetation, the new water systems will be able to take care of that even during future droughts while conserving water. I'm really excited about that one.
That seems like you're conserving water and using water simultaneously.
Well, right now we use, you know, a lot of water actually goes through our rainbird systems to irrigate the current parks. In the future, it will be drip irrigation and soaker hoses, so we'll use less water but get better results for it.
We're talking to Reese Peterson, Executive Director of the Santa Fe Conservation Trust. How is this program administered? I mean, and who when the dollars come in, who starts spending them?
Well, the both the City Council and the Parks Advisory Committee and the Bicycle Trails Advisory Committee, both of which are citizens' committees, will be working with a master plan that they've already developed to finalize the priorities for spending. But in particular, what I like about this particular bond is that the monies are going to be set aside in a special account that is only accessible for parks and trails improvement. Other parts of the city government will not be able to touch those monies. And it will be annually audited and made public so that we'll really know that the money is being spent wisely. I think that's a really smart move.
Indeed.
So the benefit to the city, I think, is pretty obvious. We're going to get improved trails. We're going to get neighborhoods getting to know each other a little better. You know, trails are a way for neighbors to start to get to know one another. It's been shown that when a trail is put through a neighborhood and people start using it, the neighborhood actually gets safer. If you think about it, it makes sense.
Yeah.
People are keeping their eye on the neighborhood. People are starting to get to know one another as they walk their dogs and that sort of thing.
And it's one of my, what would you say, sad observations is that people do not let their children run around the way that we were ran around when we were little kids.
Absolutely. Somehow there's this atmosphere of mistrust or fear that's grown up since you and I were kids. And I think that trails are a really healthy way for parents and children to get out together. And the parents can still keep an eye on the kids and feel comfortable, but the kids also get to explore nature. That's so important.
And with any luck, they'll just let their kids go for 5 minutes.
That would be nice. And, you know, actually, if you think about it, if you're a parent and you have kids who you trust to ride on their bike safely, but you're not particularly comfortable about them riding in traffic, going on one of these urban trails is a pretty nice, comfortable thing for a parent to allow their children to do.
You spoke a moment ago about citizens, I think it was Citizens Advisory Committee?
Yes.
How does a citizen get to be on one of those?
Well, applications. Once in a while they say we have an opening on the committee, and they just put the word out saying, do you know anyone, for example, who's interested in bicycling and would make a good person to help us, you know, plan and propose plans for new bicycle trails or improved bicycle trails or issues in the city? And they just put the word out. As a matter of fact, I think there might be an opening on the Bicycle Trails Advisory Committee right now, and I can check on that. If any of your listeners are interested, they can contact me at the Santa Fe Conservation Trust.
And how do they do that?
Our phone number is 989-7019.
And what's the website?
www.sfct.org.
As in Santa Fe Conservation Trust.
Exactly.
Of which Reese Peterson is the executive director. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Mary Charlotte, it was a delight to be here, and we'll see you tomorrow at the voting booths.
Excellent. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.